Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're speaking with Mark Parker, co-author of Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. He's also a professor of English at James Madison University. And we welcome back Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law, where students investigate and litigate wrongful convictions of inmates throughout Virginia. She's here to talk about one of the project's clients, Trudy Munoz, who was wrongfully convicted in a shaken baby syndrome in 2009 in that case. According to Enright, not only did she not shake the baby, who is alive and well today, but her CPR helped save the baby's life. Munoz now also faces immediate deportation upon her release this month from prison, which will cause Munoz another separation from her husband and children. We'll hear all about that case and what is being done. In just a year and a half, we on this program have spoken to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. Nancy Lawrence, my friend, are you there?
Ellen, I'm here. I'm totally here. You know, I was thinking about all those guests that you just referenced, and I'm a little worried that we have never asked any of them for their photo ID. I don't know if that's required of radio shows, but we have not done that. And in fact, I've never shown you my photo ID, and I've been co-hosting with you. And
but
I don't know.
I do want to ask them: would they prefer a bumper sticker that they can peel off, or would they prefer? What was the other thing we were going to do? A bumper sticker or a postcard?
A magnet.
A magnet. That's the question. One of the questions we can put on Twitter. What would you, as a guest, because we want to give some giveaways. Anyway.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. So I have finally been able to take a little vacation. As you might know, the smallest state, it turns out, Rhode Island, has much more going on than I ever imagined. I went to the Providence area.
I've heard of Providence.
I know.
So it's still there. It did not float into the water. We haven't melted it off the coast yet. Okay, yeah.
Not quite. Don't bring me there. I'm trying to talk and relish in the oysters I ate and the ice cream I ate. I found this little spot. I love to find little hole-in-the-wall spots. There was a place as I was driving into Providence. I looked at it. I knew it was going to be amazing, and it was. Dune Brothers, their specialty is shark fish and chips. But I opted for the stone fruit and tomato salad and the afternoon delight oysters. They were
okay. I'll
great.
Ask why did you opt for that, not the shark thing?
Well, I don't love the fried food kind of thing, and I was just feeling, you know, I had a lot of ice cream the night before. You know what I mean? So I just went for a lighter, and it was really, really hot. So, you know, next time, a lot of this trip was next time I'll get there, next time I'll do that. So, you know, hopefully, if we have a world, I'll be back.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if Trump's planning on selling Rhode Island to, or selling, excuse me, granting Rhode Island to Putin. I think it would be Alaska. So you, I think you have some time, but who knows?
Well, there's a lot I could talk about. Like, here's your choice. Do you want to hear about the hot and cold spas, or do you want to hear about fire water?
Oh, fire water. Yikes.
They light the river.
What else are we doing wrong? No, go ahead.
They light the canal on fire. It's not all on fire, but it's this event that happens about once a month in the summer. This one was to raise awareness of Hep C, and it's really amazing. It's like watching a fire fireplace, you know, that mesmerizing feeling you get when you're watching, but you're all, everyone's all along the banks of the canal, and it's really cool, and they're nice street vendors that come, and it was really not to be missed.
That does not sound like what I thought. I thought it had some sort of hellish, you know, dark turn to it, which was why it was good you had some ice cream, you know, but anyway. No, that sounds very, very nice, and I'm guessing nobody required you to walk into any of these joints wearing ostrich leather or anything highfalutin
like
that, right?
No, not at all.
No dress codes?
No.
In Providence?
No. I just heard some squeaking. So anyway, let's talk about a little bit what's going on here in town to more dire matters. A lot as the anniversary approaches, marking the summer of hate. There is a Why We Protest panel on August 7th. That's this Tuesday. It is being sponsored by Black Lives Matter Charlottesville. It is about why they and we don't just ignore white supremacists who gather in public spaces. They're going to explain the importance of visible and vocal protest and direct action in thwarting the spread of fascism. That is August 7th, Tuesday at 7 o'clock, Jefferson School, African American Heritage Center. There's a lot. I'm not going to talk about it all, but just go to Facebook. A lot of fighting back and, I guess commemorating it in that way by talking more about what's so important about the resistance and fighting white supremacy, etc.
Yeah, the events that I am going to mention are more, well, they're all, you know, these are all national. It doesn't matter if it happened in Charlottesville. Mine is Mr. Kavanaugh and I'm back on the calling the Senate switchboard, or you can text SCOTUS at 21333 or call Senator Grassley's office 202-224-3744. He is trying to hide virtually everything that Kavanaugh ever wrote during his White House tenure. Of course, they're all trying to speed through his vote, which is so typical of them. But anyway, if you text that number or call, just insist, even to your own senators, that he release all the documents, that everyone gets to read everything that guy's ever written, for obvious reasons, which I won't state here. But that's mine, Kavanaugh. Yeah.
Thank you. That's really great. So with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our first guest, Mark Parker. He is a professor of English at James Madison University. He has written this book, Sucking Up. He's also a co-author of Inferno Revealed, From Dante to Dan Brown. In this book, Sucking Up, he and his wife, Deborah Parker, wrote it together. They explore the yes men and women in literature and, of course, politics. It is, I have to say, very humorous, revealing, and a very adeptly written homage to brown nosing and sucking up. So, Mark,
I think you're doing an excellent example right there.
I was going to say,
right,
Mark,
there,
you
right
look
there.
Amazing.
He saw it, I saw it. We all heard it.
Mark, you look amazing, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
I'm welcoming you even more, though, Mark.
Totally. I can feel
totally
it.
Totally welcoming you more. Okay, I'm sorry.
They asked Ellen about you when you got here, so you must have done something right, Nancy. So what prompted you to write such a book?
Well, this is a topic that everybody knows about and everybody feels every day and sees every day. But my wife and I, my co-author, were at a dinner party, and it was mostly people at the university, and they were talking about one person in the administration, and multiple stories emerged about her sycophancy and people sucking up to her. And it was funny and appalling and kind of disturbing at the same time as these stories are being told, but we thought we would like to think a little bit harder about how this works and how it goes beyond just a funny story or an annoying kind of everyday occurrence in the workplace.
How can you tell when flattery is what the intention? How can you tell? How does one tell what the intention of flattery is?
That is the age-old question, and it's one that's addressed even to almost 2,000 years ago. Plutarch, the Greek philosopher, basically wrote an essay, How to Tell a Friend from a Flatterer, and he gave some hints, but he immediately admits that it's very difficult to draw the difference between these two things, drawing that line between what is just friendly and a kind of sociable sort of talk and something that's flattery is different. A couple of the things that are important to note is that flattery are sycophancy by nature, is its manipulative intent and also often deceptive execution. And between those two kinds of criteria, sometimes you can make a distinction.
But you don't distinguish between everybody, there's almost an excuse for everything that we do, or everything we do is maybe to get approval or to, so you're probably making a distinction between the real deceitful kinds of flattery.
Yes, that's okay. What I'm trying to do.
Okay.
And not just, I think one of the things we found immediately was that we have a tendency to think about flattery and sycophancy as transactional. You do it, you sort of get along, you go along to get along, as the adage goes. But what we found in thinking about it and looking back at how people have written about flattery and sycophancy is that it has other effects. One level is social and one level is on the self. You become a different person when you immerse yourself in this kind of activity. And often you do things that tear at the fabric of society when you sort of participate in this kind of flattery on a large scale.
Oh, so is it like immoral, or sometimes
I think many times it's immoral, and I think sometimes we're thoughtless about moments where we're actually weakening the kinds of social bonds that are set up. One of the authors who did the best job of sort of making this clear was Dante. This is basically my wife's bailiwick. She is a Dante scholar. But one of the things that she finds, and I think anyone who teaches Dante's Inferno finds, that's really odd, is that Dante puts flatterers below murderers, which seems just completely sort of hard to understand for anyone in the modern world. But he makes a very interesting set of decisions about that in making that case, and he brings some interesting evidence to light. He associates it with other kinds of fraud, and it's often easy to overlook the fact that true flattery, true sycophancy is fraudulent in a certain sense. But he also suggests that it has an effect on society, that it weakens the kind of ability of us to do the kinds of things that we really want to do in life if we cannot trust someone's word, if we're not sure we're getting a clear picture of things and people around us.
Well, that makes me think of our current president. You wrote, "We clearly will see an extravaganza of fawning, flattering, and flunkyism over the next few years, and we should take the widest possible view of this practice in order to dispute it." Did you say dispute it?
I don't.
And I'm looking at my paper now. It doesn't make sense. I think in order to dispute it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So can you talk about the presidency, which is really what I think about when I think about your book?
This is, when we wrote the book, when we started writing it, Trump was really not on the horizon. He was just a kind of fringe candidate, and no one really took him seriously.
I miss those days. I'm sorry. Go on.
I think we all do. But he was a fringe candidate. And it was only when we were just about finished with the book that the Trump administration started, he had been elected, and they started showing their true colors. So this administration started off with a sort of a cannon blast of sycophancy with Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway, and I miss him very much, Anthony Scaramucci, probably the most memorable in his five-day tenure, who stood in front of the camera and said, "I love Trump, I love Trump, I love Trump." It was just a kind of a real display. Those people have either receded or they're all gone, but at the same time, new people have come up. It seems to be that the Trump administration finds ways to attract people who are willing to do this, to be sycophants, to be flatterers. Now we have Peter Navarro, we have Rudy Giuliani, and of course Mnuchin, who was recently dubbed the greatest sycophantic cabinet member in history by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. There seems to be a sort of an endless supply of them. And of course, let's not forget the kind of baseline sycophancy of Mike Pence, who kind of began this whole sycophantic extravaganza in the June 12th cabinet meeting a couple of years ago, in which he sort of started a kind of chain reaction of sycophancy as everyone went around the room and talked about how humble and honored they were to be sort of in the administration. He's sort of kept that up, and he's one of the few that have remained in this. It was just a few months ago that he managed to sort of give a flattery every 12.5 seconds, according to one person. Mm-hmm. There was a 3-minute period with 14 flattering comments at a cabinet meeting.
Crazy.
You know, and the senators too, I can't remember, well, they're still doing it. You know, if given the chance, they always seem to shoehorn in that he's that he's the best president. He's going to go down in history as the best president. They're always, pushing the most and the greatest, just like does. And I was wondering what your feelings are about, you know, Trump does this too. He does this with, we just saw him do it in Helsinki. He does it every chance he gets with dangerous dictators. I guess that's redundant. But what about him? I'd like to hear your opinion about how he does it to himself.
That was a little bit surprising in a certain sense that Susan Rice called the summit meeting with Putin a tragic performance of sycophancy, which shows how common the word is. Now everybody knows the word sycophancy. When a year ago when our book came out, we often did interviews and people, the first thing we did was talk about how to pronounce it. It was not a common word, but now it's really part of the lexicon of everyday life, and talking about politics is to label someone a sycophant, to note their sycophancy and to comment upon it. He's a classic representation of a type that psychologists have talked about with sycophancy, of the lick-up and kick-down variety. Part of sycophancy's interest is that it's not simply receiving it. It's almost every sycophant is also someone who wants to receive sycophancy. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain sense in which every snob is also a flatterer mm-hmm. on the other side.
That's really interesting. Can you talk about the origin of the word a little bit? So it has something to do with figs. I know there's a lot of, in your book, a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, it's a kind of a compound of two Greek words. One's pheno, which is to show, and one is soukon, which is the fig. So it's showing the fig. There's a lot of discussion of different sort of origin myths for that. It could be that the sycophant is someone who's able to find this sort of fruit amidst a kind of a profusion of vines. But it's also, there was a kind of an import tax on figs at this time. And so showing the fig would be someone who would come and basically show that someone was importing figs illegally. And so they were kind of a person who was a self-appointed sheriff who was finding malefactors in the fig trade.
Interesting.
It's really difficult to sort of point out exactly what it is. But certainly all of the stories bring together the duplicity and the cunning and often the aggression behind sycophancy.
Mm-hmm. Besides the current administration, when else in political history have you come across excellent sycophants in history?
Yeah, one of the things I'd certainly like to say is that this is not the province of simply one party or one time. There's maybe the only difference now, and we could come back to this later, is that it's more open. There are people who are more obvious about what they're doing when they're doing it. For a long time, it was hidden. And if you look at the tapes from Watergate, there's a lot of sycophancy on those tapes. It's just appalling, especially what some figures like Kissinger managed to do in sucking up to Richard Nixon. But it was hidden, and they expected it only to come out later, if at all. And certainly in the Johnson administration, there was a great deal of sycophancy behind the war effort. But again, it was hidden, and it was something that people were ashamed of. Now people aren't seemingly so ashamed of presenting themselves as sycophants. They've managed to sort of morph it into a kind of hyper-loyalty or a kind of team spirit rather than really what it is.
In your view, is brown nosing an art form? Is it in your view?
Yes. And one of the things that, again, in our book we come back to again and again is how good literature is at sort of trying to describe the actual procedures and the way in which sycophants operate. If you think of just a book like The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith, what you have is a character who is a kind of inveterate sycophant, but through his sycophancy, through his flatteries, through his willingness to sort of suck up to people who are powerful, whom he admires, he actually forges a kind of character for himself. So there's a sense in which he builds himself up through this imaginative act of thinking that people around him are better than they are and sort of managing to suck up and to sort of build them up through this. It's a kind of, there is a great deal of art, and certainly, as the title says, he's quite talented. His ability to sort of find ways of sucking up and to become that other person through emulation and sycophancy is really remarkable.
We'll be right back. We're going to take a hard break. We're talking with Mark Parker, author of Sucking Up, A Brief Consideration of Sycophancy. And in just a few moments, we're going to talk with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocent Project at the University of Virginia's School of Law. We'll talk about the very important case that they have taken on. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Mark Parker. So, Mark, talk a little bit about how the Trump presidency is different, if it is, than the other presidencies that have come before.
Well, the one difference is really not of their own making. I think that sycophancy in today's media really poses a different kind of a threat to the world around us. There's a sense in which by being able to go on media so quickly through Twitter, through all of these other platforms, we get a kind of echo chamber of sycophancy, which, if you think about it, is part of what sycophancy does, is to create a kind of reality. And we get that in a kind of much more sort of pervasive and sort of powerful way with this group of people.
And even, I was wondering, even in terms of business that they conduct, I mean, I was like Pruitt, you know, mm-hmm. all of the back and forth that he was benefiting from, that too is I know they're not telling him he's the best secretary, but the things that the back deals they're making in a way, that is that not some form of sycophancy or no?
Well, in another sense, this is also one other difference between, I think, modern and older forms of sycophancy. It used to be sycophancy was a terrible thing, and to be called a sycophant was a real offense, a flatterer. Now, sometimes people think of it as an art form or as someone who knows how to get their way. It's become transactional. And the myth is that you can enter into it on a quid pro quo basis and find some way of extracting yourself without actually being transformed. And I think that's a real myth. Dante had it right. I mean, I didn't mention the punishment for sycophancy in the Divine Comedy, but they're covered in excrement, the people who do this. You don't sort of get out of this. This is a kind of thing that sticks to you and that you'll never wash yourself clean of.
Wow. Are there other ways that this presidency is different? Or I know in your book you mentioned Kellyanne Conway and her. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
These are easy targets, but yeah. At one point she had been through several weeks at this point in her tenure where she had been sycophantic and been sort of just fawning over everything Trump did. But at one point when she was finally given a job, and I'm not sure what the title was because it's not really a real job, but she was finally given an official position in the administration, and she managed to, first she let out a press release, a regular one on paper, then she went on TV, and so she went on that media, and then she went on Twitter. So she managed to suck up in three different platforms in one morning. She had to tell everyone that she was humble and gratified by this appointment on three different platforms. And again, that plays into what the target of sycophancy wants, is that larger and larger audience and more sort of evidence of their greatness.
What about the media in general?
That is a tough one, because it really has this display of sycophancy in the in the White House and in the administration has really kind of created more sycophants. And I think that there are some elements of the media that just seem to be operating in terms of just pure outright sycophancy. We've never quite seen that kind of level of assent and that level of conformity. We have often seen media who have a line that they want to take, but this seems to go beyond that. Everything that the president does, according to some media outlets, is wonderful.
Yeah, they do. They certainly don't seem to cover what he says. They cover everything he says, and not enough of them, you know, seem to mention that he may be lying or he's not. He's lying, but they cover it, and I know he gets such a thrill from all of that media coverage, even if they are the enemy of the people. That is not a question. My question is this, Mark. Is it easier to track sycophancy in literature versus, you know, the world where people have real intentions that, as you say, sometimes are hidden? Is it easier to track it in literature?
That's the great value of literature. And one of the things that we were interested in writing this book was to show that literature can do certain things and perform certain kinds of analysis very well. With literature, you're inside, and so there's a kind of empathetic treatment in which you go into the mind and into the formation of some of the people who are performing these kinds of acts of flattery and sycophancy. And so literature, it really gives us a sort of an inside view of how this works and what its effects are.
What's the next book? Do you have one?
I have to say, I'm at a loss. We don't have one yet. Mm-hmm. We usually sort of, the last few books that we've written together, my wife and I, have come just when something happened. Mm-hmm. We were watching a DVD commentary, and we thought we should really think about how DVD commentary really might affect film study. And then we had the Dan Brown sort of opportunity to write on Dante, so we did that. And they all come up just by chance, so we're still open to the future.
How about open to, you just by chance happen to be on this radio show, apropos of something, two friends from high school, just do this show. No, I'm just teasing.
You're crossing the line into obsequiousness, which is probably very, very close to sycophancy.
Yeah, they're all SAT words.
Right.
Go on, Nance.
As far as the book you did write, Mark, on called Inferno Revealed, was that did not. I know it has, as you mentioned, he talks about flattery and being worse than murder. But why else did you write that book? I'm sure it had nothing to do with that.
Well, we were interested in the ways Dante has been adapted over time, and so much of the book is about different adaptations of Dante and the trajectory of the book, because it was a commercial book, was to time the release with Dan Brown's novel Inferno. And so we were able to write about his book in the last chapter as a sort of one of the latest in a long line of Dante adaptations. So we were interested in really the literary kind of side of adaptation.
And in terms of why it is so significant, what's your view? Why has it prevailed all these years, all these many thousand, whatever, you know?
Well, there's something about a thinker like Dante, is that even the unregarded small parts, like the fact that he puts flatterers in the eighth circle of hell in a little pocket among 10 and connects them in such interesting ways with other kinds of fraud, is a measure of his complexity and depth. There's always something you can find new in a text like Dante's Inferno. It's seemingly endless in terms of what it can allow us to think through and to learn.
Well, in terms of the flattery thing, I mean, I know I was the one that asked you about the literature connection. What other characters in literature are good with, you know, pointing out, you know, how to be a brown noser best?
How to be a brown noser. One of the best and one of the kind of the darkest sort of depictions of flattery is in an Austen novel, Sense and Sensibility, where there's a virtuoso flatterer, Lucy Steele, who manages through just assiduous work and willingness to actually abase herself in front of anyone, she manages to sort of come out on top. She marries well. She marries, to her mind, quite happily to a rich man. Austen often has a kind of a darker side among all the light and bright and sparkling of her wit. But here's a moment. She basically says someone who is a flatterer doesn't have to pay at the end. She goes on to basically get what she wants. That's a very interesting depiction. Dickens has another virtuoso flatterer in Uriah Heep in David Copperfield. And what's most interesting about that depiction is the way he manages to sort of think of Heap's character as a sort of state-sponsored sycophancy. He is trained to be a sycophant by his bringing up in a charity school, and then ultimately he ends up in a prison sucking up to the warden. There's a kind of sense in which from cradle to grave, the certain people are induced into acts of flattery. And again, that's a rather interesting analysis in terms of the depth, as opposed to thinking of flattery as just a transaction.
What do you think it says about us as a society that we are definitely, I don't know if it's the golden age, but it's pervasive here now, you know? So what's wrong with us? What's going
on? That's an interesting question, and one that we thought a lot about when we were writing. It's perfectly understandable in a social formation that is based on a monarchy with a court. You can understand how flattery works there when you have an absolute ruler basically able to make and break people by what he does. Flattery seems like a necessary component of a kind of court life. One of the things democracy often argued for itself was that it granted an independence and an autonomy to its citizens, and she would not need this kind of recourse to flattery to get on in the world. You could make the world according to your own merit and your own sort of character. But oddly, we seem to be coming back to that kind of monarchical and that kind of that kind of a culture. It seems that our democracy is under a kind of duress from this kind of economy, which seems to reward flattery.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And when you write your next book, please come back. Very articulate and learned person, Mark Parker, professor of English.
Ellen.
That's what I usually do on this show. It's not special.
I've learned nothing. I just wanted to also add, Mark, one of the best guests we've ever had on to discuss flattery. That I can tell you. Okay, I'm done.
That sounds fair, since I don't think you've had another.
Right, that is true.
Flattery discussing guest.
That's not the point.
Well, he's a professor of English, as I was saying, at James Madison University. Thanks for the laughs and for this great book. It really is a really interesting, like, it's really fun to read, I must say. I am saying all this stuff authentically, really. So thanks for being here.
I'll never trust
Thank you
again.
Okay. Hey, and then very soon after we do our news of note, we're going to speak with Deirdre Enright, director of the Innocent Project at the University of Virginia. Looking forward to what she has to say. And Nancy, do you have a news of note?
I do, and I have timed mine, or whatever it is, themed mine. It has a bit of sycophancy, collusion, and a strong whiff of Pruitt. It appears that Halliburton is sucking up to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, if bribery is some sort of kind of sucking up. Anyway, there's a Halliburton development in the works on land in Zinke's hometown of Whitefish, Montana, which includes building a microbrewery. And why that is significant is that he's very into microbrewery, micro beer, and it's similar to a proposal that he himself had long sought for the town to approve, because he is a craft beer enthusiast. But his project failed because he wanted to put it on his own land, and the city council wouldn't approve it because of zoning laws. But here comes Halliburton. They have their own project, just conveniently now, that includes this land that they're going to establish a microbrewery on. And as you know, Halliburton is the nation's largest oil services company, and they're one of the biggest winners of every rollback that Zinke has done on Obama regulations on fracking. Any oil drilling permitted in the country, that's his decision, Zinke. So now the department's Inspector General is investigating whether Zinke has colluded with the chairman of Halliburton to build him this pet project, because, of course, there are ethics rules that bar him from having official contacts set up, you know, gigs for your post-government life. So that is my news of note. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not officially established yet, it sure sounds like something.
Yeah.
Fishy in Whitefish. What do you got?
Is Cheney still own that, or in bed with Halliburton? Because I remember that from the Iraq War.
Yes. That's when I first learned that word myself. I don't know, Ellen, if he is.
Okay.
I don't know. Sure.
Which reminds me of an anecdote from the book we just were talking about, that the victim of Cheney's, remember when he shot someone accidentally?
Yes. Birdshot.
The victim, they cited, authors, Parker's cited that, you know, that the victim had, he didn't have to, but he did apologize and was like, I hope you come back to the state. It was really, talk about obsequiousness and sycophancy.
Yeah.
It was really disgusting. I didn't remember that about it, but it was,
you're right.
It was
hard
really
to
weird
read. That he apologized for getting shot. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so I was just going to say something local, a news of note, that from WJLA, ABC, and DC, sources told members of the Metro, the way you get around town there, the largest union, that the Ku Klux Klan-affiliated hate group will receive special accommodations following the Unite the Right rally in DC upcoming. And they said that they're going to get 3 private Metro rail cars and a police escort that will allegedly stop at the Foggy Bottom Metro station on August 11th and 12th. From there, sources say the group will march through the streets of D.C. before arriving at Lafayette Park for the rally. It's disgusting. Yeah. Which we witnessed here, a lot of protection of alt-right. So, on that note, we have a lovely person who does really, really difficult work. I don't know how she does it, but thank goodness she does. Deirdre Enright is a director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law, where students investigate and litigate wrongful convictions of inmates throughout Virginia. She's going to talk about one of the project's clients, Trudy Munoz, who was wrongfully convicted in a so-called shaken baby syndrome case in 2009. According to Enright, not only did Munoz not shake the baby, who is well, but her CPR helped save the baby's life. Munoz now faces immediate deportation upon her release, August 13th, this month, from prison, which will cause another separation from her husband and children. She's already been separated for 10 years. She's served her time. Welcome back to the show, Deirdre.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know part of your mission is to prove that wrongful convictions happen, and they continue to happen, and you've said at a rate that would shock the average citizen. So before we get into the case, tell us about the Innocence Project. Tell us a little bit about what you guys do.
So at UVA, we started our Innocence Project 10 years ago. We're a spinoff of the mothership, the Innocence Project in New York, that was started by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. And so we're part of a network of Innocence Projects that grow sort of exponentially and now are global, proving wrongful convictions. And it used to be that DNA was the beginning of showing how they were people were wrongfully convicted. Now we know that there's pretty much seven leading causes, and it includes eyewitness IDs, police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, junk science, and that's what prevailed in this case, was the fact that doctors are now allowed to presume that somebody, that a child was traumatically injured when they see three things, and that's the retinal hemorrhaging, subdural hematoma, and edema, swelling of the brain. And so in this case, those three things were present, and so they were allowed to presume that the person who was with the baby at the time, which was Trudy, caused those symptoms by shaking the baby. Now, the problem in this case is there was not a single sign of trauma. There was no bruising. There was no injured neck. And the child had a cortical thrombosed vein in his head, which many doctors would say could not happen because of shaking.
We're going to come back after this break, and we're going to hear much more about this case with Deirdre Enright. We'll be right back. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome back. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Deirdre Enright.
Hey, Deirdre, I know right before the break you were just getting in kind of a little bit into what shaken baby syndrome is and how it does not apply here, but continue with what that is and why it doesn't apply in this case.
Well, for one, in this case, it doesn't apply because there was no traumatic injury of any kind. And also, the child had other signs of things that would have caused what happened to him. He had an infection in his lungs. The retinal hemorrhages appeared to be consistent or could have been consistent with meningitis, but he was never tested. The cortical thrombosed vein can be caused by infection, dehydration, and those things were present. And so what actually happened that's shocking and horrifying is that when Trudy explained to the Child Protective Services worker how she put the baby on her shoulder to sort of jiggle him, she was afraid he was choking on milk, which she had been giving him at the time that he began seizing. The CPS worker said, "That's shaking." And so she turned what was an explanation of not shaking a baby into an admission of shaking a baby.
Mm-hmm. Can you set the scene as you were describing? I realized we hadn't. Just say the facts of the case.
So Trudy had a daycare center in the basement of her home. She had been caring for children for 7 years. She was fully licensed, fully accredited, fully trained. She'd taken care of very difficult children in the past and successfully. And this child had only been coming to her daycare center for a couple of weeks. And All the other children were napping, and Trudy was feeding him a bottle. He had been fussy that day. He had had wheezing and stridor, a loud sound when he was breathing. And she went to give him a bottle, and he began seizing. And she recognized immediately that it was trouble. She put him on her shoulder to make sure there was no milk in his airway, and then began giving him CPR. She called 911. She was talked through that and kept him alive until EMTs came, and they took him to the PICU unit at Fairfax Innova. And he was a very sick child, and it took many days. He had seizures repeatedly, and it took a long time to get him well. One of the things that was noted at the hospital was the father told the intake workers that a wooden plaque had fallen on the child's head with 7 to 10 days. We now know that that can happen. You can brain bleed for a long time, and then it can re-bleed, and it's called a lucid interval.
Why wasn't that brought up?
It's interesting. There's photos of the hospital measuring. There was a mark on his head. You could see it was visible. They were measuring it. They were photographing it. They clearly thought it was relevant. And then the word came, and it's in the notes, the hospital notes, that the Child Protective Services worker called and said, she's admitted to shaking. And it just sort of, everything went sideways.
Because it was like an easy answer for them.
Yeah.
And maybe not blame is one thing I thought of. Maybe the father dropped, they don't have culpability if it's someone else's fault.
Sure. I have four children, and I have to imagine I would much rather think that someone else did this to my child than that I did it or contributed to it. But one thing that you can absolutely know from talking to all the people who saw Trudy take care of children was that she had the patience of, Job. She just doesn't lose it. It's sort of not in her DNA. She's just that kind of a nurturer. So the idea, and it's interesting, in all the shaken baby cases that have been prosecuted in this country so far, not a single one has a witness to the shaking. No one has ever witnessed the shaking that causes this condition. And we're learning sort of on a daily basis that there are all these things, mimics, like illnesses and congenital abnormalities that cause those three things. But doctors have to presume trauma.
I'm curious, during the trial, did the jury know that Trudy never said that she shook the baby, even though the social worker apparently lied and said that she did? Did that come out?
Trudy took the stand and said she did not admit to shaking. The CPS worker took the stand and said she did admit to shaking. Two things that are really relevant here is both of her lawyers have admitted that they were ineffective. For a long time, because the child lived, I think they believed these charges would be dismissed. So they took a long time just presuming that it would go away. One was an immigration lawyer. One was a medical malpractice lawyer. So she did not have any criminal defense lawyer in her corner. And the jurors did not hear from the primary doctor who was going to say that this could not have been caused by shaking. He was, in fact, going to come from Stanford University and testify for free because he was so convinced that this was not shaking. He couldn't come on the day of the trial, and the lawyers did not know they could get a continuance. Oh, so they never heard that. They also never heard about the wooden plaque falling
that
on his head.
Crazy. Yeah, why didn't they hear about that?
I was the person that saw that record. There was 1,009 pages. And so the prosecutors didn't want to bring it up, and the defense attorneys missed it.
Oh, wow. So you would talk about, that it's really not a real condition, shaken baby syndrome. I know it's based on some, what I read was crazy experiments maybe done in the 80s or something. Can you elaborate on that?
On apes? Yeah. Is that what you read about?
Yeah, is that true?
So, of course, now, you can't shake infants, right, to do this kind of testing. So there's a constant effort to use animals until it's prevented. So there's a series of animals that have been shaken, apes, piglets, I think, is the most recent thing that we've been shaking. The amazing thing about it is that I would think that as a doctor, you would want to use science as opposed to a legal presumption in making a determination, right? Mm-hmm. So why doctors don't want to do science is sort of mystifying to me, that you would rather believe a child protective services worker than test for meningitis and look for the reasons for the infection and the temperature and, you know, these, it's a little bit...
It's the easy way, perhaps.
It's pretty lazy.
Yeah.
It's pretty lazy. Although, you know, to be fair, too, once they see those things, by law, they have to report it. So that begins this train, you know, running down the track. And after that, I mean, the lawyers who defend these cases now, and there's a group of them that specialize in it, you have to learn a lot about science and medicine to defend these cases properly. Mm-hmm. And Trudy didn't have that.
Were there other errors? I mean, these are significant. I mean, the fact that a doctor didn't testify, and the fact that shaken baby syndrome doesn't really apply if they'd had a medical professional on the stand. Were there other errors as well that Trudy is suffering from when she had her trial?
Well, besides that she should have had different lawyering and that doctor mm-hmm. should have appeared, there should have been, I think, much more focus put on the fact that the child didn't have any bruises. If you're going to shake a baby into a traumatic or damaged state, there should be other injuries on the body. And this child had no other bruising, no other, no neck injuries whatsoever. And if you think of an infant that's, you know, 4.5 months old, if you shake that baby, there's going to be signs that you did that. Somebody else pointed out to me that they should have focused on the fact that, you know, had it been an hour later, he would have been in the car seat in his mother's car, and then she would have been, you know, mm-hmm. or presumably accused in the same way. Mm-hmm. I think Trudy's mm-hmm. status, right, the fact that when we interviewed jurors later, now it was years later, two things became very clear to us. Several asked us, wasn't she just an illegal immigrant? The idea being, I presume, why would we care about this? Mm-hmm. And her status, her legal status, was not relevant in any way to this case. Mm-hmm. And the science is dry, right? If you're a juror and you're having to listen to doctors, there's one issue that comes up in these cases medically and scientifically, which is that jurors tend to believe whoever says, I treated the child. He was here. He was in my PICU unit. I put my hands on him. The defense experts are always the people who come months later. They presumably usually review records. So that they're accused of that they didn't put hands on. Now the doctors would say, I think the doctors on the defense side would say, we're the doctors that do the research. We're the doctors that have been studying these issues for years. They're the doctors that keep you alive. Mm-hmm. They don't know, you know, they don't read the scans as well as we do. And so that's a big issue, too. And then you put on top of it that jurors are bored by scientific evidence.
Once again, the short attention span of humanity. So tell us how you got the case and where it stands now.
So we got the case immediately after her direct appeal was concluded. So she was just tried and found guilty and then had one direct appeal. Then lawyers from Northern Virginia came to us and said, this woman should never have been convicted. We'll do anything that we can do to help. Please take the case. I think we had like 2 months to do a habeas petition. Matthew Engel was working on this case with me. We have not gotten in 10 years, 9 years, a single court to look at this case. And now it's in front of the governor. We've asked him for an absolute pardon for Trudy to try and prevent her deportation on August 13th.
So when she gets released August 13th, ICE is just going to sweep in.
That is what we've been told.
Mm-hmm. And she has two children. I don't know if we mentioned.
She has two amazing daughters. One is 14 and starting high school, Ximena, and the other was in college. They're both in Northern Virginia. Renata is her older daughter. They visit her all the time, but for a long time they thought their mother would walk out the door and they could bring her to their home in Northern Virginia, and it's pretty new to them that isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think, Deirdre, what do you think it helps or hurts that the governor has apparently is a pediatric neurologist as well in his past? Is that, what do you think?
So I was totally excited when I was told that this case was going to be in his hands, because I thought a pediatric neurologist could just look at that MRI and see the cortical thrombosed vein and know that nobody shook that baby. But recently, a reporter in Charlottesville asked him if he knew about the case, and he said he did not. And he said, she said, "Do you know about shaken baby syndrome?" And he said, "I know all about it. When I was a neurologist, we told people not to shake their babies. We put the word out that people should not shake their babies, and we still got one case a month," which makes me think
he doesn't know.
He doesn't know about the syndrome.
Right.
We've recently written him a letter asking him to watch the 90-minute documentary called The Syndrome, which explains this in detail.
Do you recommend that we write him? I mean, what can we do as lay people?
I think anybody who would and could should write, call, text, because I think that's awareness would help.
I mean, he could just pardon and just make this go away completely.
He could give us the absolute pardon, and we could take it to the immigration court and beg them to defer and not deport her.
And that's Ralph Northam.
It is.
There are other states, not Virginia apparently, that have responded to reviewing cases of shaken baby syndrome. Does that help?
We tried to use the fact that there's many states that are reviewing cases of shaken baby and overturning them. You can look at the Northwestern University website on shaken babies, and the fascinating thing is that there are hot spots for shaking babies in the country. So Virginia has them too, Tidewater and Northern Virginia. And what that actually is, of course, people don't, it's hard to believe that certain areas of the state and the country are where you shake your baby. Mm-hmm. So what it actually is places where they have aggressive medical centers and child protective services workers that are, mm-hmm. there's a lot of money infused in having these cases be brought. So we tried to use Wisconsin as a state that is really aggressive about this. Some countries have addressed it, Sweden and Great Britain, and have spent a lot of time saying this should go away.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, the governor, you know what? I don't want to go there. Let's just say he will grant the pardon.
I think I should probably be more sycophantic to the governor.
Yes. Sorry, are you... What are you doing?
We have like after the show does nothing. It should help. Yes, exactly.
We have like 30 seconds. But what is it that you guys are currently doing? Is it...
We've filed absolutely everything that we can file.
Okay.
So now we're doing this. We're
yes.
asking the public to step up and help us on
okay.
this.
I just wanted to understand. I don't doubt your work at all. Thank you so much for being here, Deirdre Enright.
Yeah.
I'm going to write to Ralph Northam. I hope everyone else does become educated about this situation.
Thank you both for having
him
me.
In the process of doing
I love you both so, so much.
Aw, Deirdre. You're amazing. Okay. Well, thanks for being with us. Nancy,
yeah.
I don't think we have time because I see another host.
Oh,
he's
okay.
ready to go, and we probably should let him do his job.
I'm in favor of not causing a kerfuffle. Yeah.
Yes, and I just wanted to mention that our theme music is by Springtide. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. See you next week. And thanks, Nance, so much, as always.
Yep. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.